Hello, my friends. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason, and glad you joined me today. Looking forward to talking to you and sharing a friend with you later on, the second hour, Mike Lacona, New Testament historian, author, Christian defender of the faith. We'll be talking about whether Jesus was just another one of those dying Messiah myths. That's hour number two. Hour number one, though, we'll talk about what's on your mind in ethics, values, and religion. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. If you're in the 714 area code, dial me direct at 754-4150. Love to talk to you. If you want to get in the queue, and lines are beginning to light up now, but plenty of room if you want to talk. Talk to the enforcer first, and if you're nice to her, she'll put you through to me. The number's again, 1-800-227-5278 and 754-4150 if you're down here in Orange County, Southern California. I just returned from the Seattle area, actually Olympia, which is south of Seattle, but it's part of the greater, you know, Puget Sound area. Had a great chance to speak at a couple of churches there, Calvary Chapel, Reality Church, which I think it's fair to say is an emerging type church right there in the city of Olympia. Wonderful time. I've spoken at both churches in the past. Got a chance to speak twice at South Puget Sound Community College, which is quite a liberal school, but I had a noontime special lecture in which I talked about the problem of evil, and the venue was completely packed out. It was a small lecture hall, probably held, maybe 120 or 130 people. Pretty much standing room only. Great to talk to them about that. You know, I always have a little bit of, to be quite candid with you, a little bit of angst whenever I go into a circumstance like that. I have a lot of confidence, obviously, in the things that I have to say. They've been tested by fire. They've been well thought through. I've heard the counterarguments. This talk on the problem of evil, I kind of knew what I was up against. But there's always that little unknown. You don't know who you're going to encounter, who might give you a stiff challenge in front of other people. And then you wonder, gee, will I be able to rise to the occasion, stay up with the tempo, be quick enough on my feet? It turns out that most of the time my concerns are unfounded, partly because the audience is utterly cordial. The rare exceptions have been Oregon State University, and this is quite a number of years ago, and just recently at Purdue. But those are rare. Normally, I get a very cordial reception, and that was the case here. And although there were a number of people who gave me pushback on some of these issues, I was a bit surprised to see, in a sense, how confused the challenges were. They just weren't well thought through. And so when I asked a couple of clarification questions, not to trick anybody, but just to get clear on what they wanted me to respond to or what their issues were, it turned out that the people were stalled out a bit because they weren't even clear on what they were thinking. And in some, I had to have them, you know, think about it a little bit more, come back to me again, and ask the question a different way. And even in one case, that wasn't even adequate. So that actually worked out quite well, and I was real happy about that. In fact, the approach that I took in dealing with the problem of evil, and many of you have heard suffering and evil and the goodness of God. It's a teaching I've done. It's available through Stand to Reason, where I kind of chart out my approach to this issue. Or we have a cassette set that has my talk and also one from William Lane Craig on it on the issue. You might have read Sophie's Dilemma, which is an article I've written that's on the website at str.org, and you can download that for free. So you know how I kind of work through the problem. But, you know, there are two problems with the problem of evil. One of them is the intellectual problem, the alleged contradiction, and the second one is that is between God's power and goodness and the reality of evil. But the second one is just the personal difficulty that one encounters when he confronts evil in his own life or her own life, and this is actually the most cogent. For the very first time, I actually led with that. I said, you know, this other thing is what we talk about, but that's not really the issue. What really is difficult for us is when we encounter evil in our own lives, and we all do at some point or another. And that's why the problem of evil isn't just a problem for the theist, the Christian. It's a problem for everybody. The atheist still has to face the problem of evil. If I looked at the problem of evil and I said, gee, I can't believe in God anymore, the problem doesn't go away. Now I have to account for the problem of evil, the exact same problem, without God. And I said the question, if you're an Eastern religion person, no matter what point of view that you adopt, you have to deal with the reality of the problem of evil. So the real issue is which worldview has the best resources, can get the best traction, if you will, to deal with the problem in a way that is satisfying. And I don't mean just emotionally satisfying, but intellectually satisfying, in a way that fits the world as it seems we encounter it. And I actually think that the theistic worldview, in particular the Christian worldview, gives not only the most intellectually compelling answer, but also the most emotionally satisfying answer. That there is that the existence of evil in the world does not undermine the existence of God in the slightest bit. It need not. That is, I understand how people will pause. It will give them pause when they think about the problem of evil in God. But there is a way of understanding how that works together that is completely reasonable, so that there's no contradiction at all on one way of looking at it. And then you have the further question of, well, how does the Christian worldview resolve the problem? And I think the answer that Jesus' worldview offers is fabulous. It shows that God has undertaken a rescue operation, and he has done very precise and specific things to rescue us from the consequences of our own foolish decisions. And it ultimately ends up with the cross. I guess, actually, ultimately, it's not the cross. That is the solution, but the ultimate working out is the new heavens and the new earth, in which evil is finally banished forever. And human beings are changed radically. Those who have received the forgiveness that the sovereign offers to those who are rebels in his kingdom and are restored to him, and are now part of his family. And a new heaven and a new earth are created, and everything turns out to be even better than what our deepest yearnings in our hearts require. It's a wonderful solution. And when I was finished, we had wonderful interaction in Q&A, and it was deeply satisfying, even for those who disagreed. I think the answer from the perspective of the worldview that Jesus believed in, and the worldview he commends to us through the Gospels and through the rest of the Scriptures, that worldview, that answer to this problem is deeply satisfying, and it does far better than any other worldview. So that was on Thursday afternoon at noon. Friday morning at 8 in the morning, I showed up at a class, and I did mention that, you know, when I was in college at Michigan State University in the middle of the winter there, 8 o'clocks were the bane of college students, but sometimes you had to take them. Fortunately, everybody showed up for this 8 o'clock, including me, and we talked. It was an ethics class, a philosophy class, in particular focusing on ethics, and so I talked about the problem of moral relativism. And again, had a great time with the class. A lot of questions, no, I would say, significant pushback. I think I was able to put a stone in their shoe and get them thinking about these issues. And though I was not advancing any Christianity or Christian worldview or theism itself, I was making the case against relativism. And I think once you make the case that objective morality is a feature of reality, then that is a solid foundation then to move to other things, like what kind of worldview best makes sense of such a thing, and how do we deal with the guilt of not keeping that worldview, and more things follow. You see, I don't think, ladies and gentlemen, I have to get to the foot of the cross in every single conversation. I don't have to, give the gospel in order to be making a significant contribution for the cause of Christ as an ambassador. Many of you know my basic policy in circumstances like this is not to preach the gospel per se, but rather to put a stone in people's shoes. I just want to get them thinking. I want to get them and have them leave there annoyed in a good way about something that I've said, so that they are stimulated by the challenge that Christianity is worth thinking about. That's all I'm after. And in some cases, I know this might stick in the craw of some people, it just simply isn't appropriate to give the gospel. When I'm asked to come in to speak on a topic like ethics, and then I move right directly into the gospel in a way that is not natural for the material I've been asked to develop, that actually leaves a negative impression in people's minds, and it looks like I've abused a trust. However, even if I don't preach the gospel in that moment, pardon me, as a follower of Christ, as an ambassador, I can set the stage with another discussion so that when the gospel is made evident to the people in that class at some future time, there may be more of a receptivity to it because of the things that I said. So sometimes I'm just out there, to use a different metaphor now, to disking the field. I'm just plowing a little bit. And maybe the seed of the gospel itself hasn't even been planted, but I've plowed it for the next ambassador to plant that seed. So it's not going to be rocky ground, but it's going to be soil that's more receptive to the growth of the seed that is planted at some future time. So anyway, that was a very satisfying time. Seems to me there's something else I wanted to tell you about that, but maybe it'll come back in a minute. Now, if you go to my Facebook, if you're one of my friends, and by the way, if you're not, you're welcome to be. Just look me up on Facebook, go there and make a request, and we'll bring you on board, probably. You'll get the inside scoop on some things. A lot of it's just my personal life, and it's kind of fun having that aspect available to our friends at Stand to Reason, where, you know, there's stuff about my family and pictures of my kids and a videotape of me bluegill fishing with Annabeth in Wisconsin last summer, things like that. But I also were able to exchange things in a more timely fashion than I'm on the radio show, because we're posting things every day. And this is where I learned, for example, that Kathy Ireland had done such a fine job on the Huckabee Show a couple of weeks ago defending the pro-life view. We had trained Kathy a number of years ago on this issue, and so it was great to see her out. We learned that there, and then, of course, posted it elsewhere, but that's where we first found out. One of our friends on Facebook put it up. But I get to post things there that I can't post anywhere else because I don't have an opportunity to, and you'll miss it if you're not on Facebook. So just go there and sign in, and you can participate. Be glad to have you, by the way. But I posted a picture of a poster that I saw hanging in a bar in Olympia, Washington, where I spent most of my time this last week. And if those of you who know the area know that Olympia is a very, very liberal town, all right? There are a lot of towns like that, but Olympia is like that too. And so here is, I'm just going to read this to you. If you're on the internet watching our video podcast, you'll be able to see this, or you can go to my Facebook, sign on board, then scroll down to this picture. I took a picture of this poster, which is a kind of advertisement of sorts for the bar that it represents. So I'm standing outside the small bar. My wife and I are walking down the road, and I saw this, and I said, I have got to take a picture of this. Unbelievable. Those of you who have listened to the tactics material or read the book, you will recognize not only the suicide in a sense, tactic in motion, that a circumstance that is obviously suicidal. But you will see in living color, quite literally, because the poster was yellow, or rather red with yellow print, what I call the intolerance of tolerance. So let me just read what it says. And frankly, no further commentary is necessary. You'll get the point. The name of the bar is Jake's. And here's what it says. Jake's is a hate-free queer bar. We welcome everybody unless you are homophobic, transphobic, racist, sexist, heterophobic, a thief, drug dealer, violent, bigot, or basic, or and then they have the A word there. If none of these apply to you, welcome! 3 exclamation points. Have a fabulous time. The staff at Jake's cares about you. If you feel that someone here is compromising our safe, hate-free space, please don't hesitate to let one of us know. Thanks, Jake's staff. Of course, the subtext of the last comment is, you know, if anybody's compromising our hate-free, tolerant, completely accepting space here, then we'll throw them out on their ear, which is exactly the point. Wouldn't it be odd, though, to have a bar where someone said, you know, you're welcome here unless you are transsexual, a certain race, a woman, a homosexual, or just unpleasant in different ways. That would be so odd. Yet here's exactly the same thing, but from the other side. Ah, yes, the fresh wind of tolerance, love, acceptance, hate-free environments. Welcome. Have a fabulous time. 1-800-227-5278. That's our number. Love to talk to you here over the next 45 minutes or so, and then our next hour devoted to our time with Mike Lacona on the historical reliability of the Gospels, especially the person of Jesus, and how to handle the challenge that the story of Jesus is just another one of those dying and rising Redeemer myths that history is strewn with. So we'll get to that in our second hour, but you're up next here on Stand to Reason. Don't go away. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material too by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Christianity worth thinking about, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you get every Sunday here. Now, I almost said 3 to 5, but that's just today. Because after today, it's 2 to 5. We have an extra hour starting next weekend, and our first hour, that would be 2 o'clock Los Angeles time, We'll be with Scott Klusendorf and his new book, and I am really looking forward to that conversation. So be sure to mark your calendars to tune in if you're listening live to this show 1 hour early. Now, are we clear yet whether the American Family Radio is picking? We don't know that yet. So you and the AFR stations, you'll just have to check it out to see if they, if you guys pick up this this extra hour or not. And we just haven't gotten word on that or not. So if we're not there at the, well, what would amount to 2 o'clock L.A. time, you just come in at a regular time and we'll be there. All right. Let's see. What do I want to do now? I think I want to go to a call. Let's go to the state of Ohio, Buckeye State. And Chris, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg.
Hello, Chris. You sound so serious today.
I was actually told that earlier.
Is that right?
Yeah. I was too serious for my age, I guess.
Okay. Well, you have a serious question?
I do.
All right. Let's hear it.
It's a little two-sided. What do you do with the objection when you start to mention extra-biblical sources for Jesus, like Tacitus and Josephus, or Pliny the Younger? Someone says, well, they're not contemporaries of Jesus, and therefore they could just be merely recording what they heard Christians say, not what they knew as history.
Mm-hmm. Well, my response would be is why, I mean, maybe they've just given at least their answer. Why would the fact that they were not contemporaries, that, and I guess what they mean by that probably is that they, not just that they lived at the same time, that strictly speaking is what a contemporary is, but that they actually were maybe very, very close to the events themselves, all right? I don't know why that would in itself be a liability. Now, what they wanted to say is, well, maybe they were just going on what Christians said, right?
Mm-hmm.
So? I mean, this is a great little powerful two-letter word, by the way. So? What you want to do is you want to make that person explain why such a circumstance is actually relevant to the question of historicity. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to find out the inside history of the Nazi Party, right? And in order to do that, you interview Nazi insiders. Maybe this isn't a good illustration because the Nazis sound awful, and I don't mean to make a parallel that with Christianity, but
right.
Since I've already started, too late, all right?
Right.
And you wanted to find out exactly what went on. And so what you do is you interview the insiders. Why would that be a liability? It seems to me that's the best source of information, the
right.
People closest to it. Right. Well, they might be lying. Sure, anybody could be lying, but a good historian, anybody worth his salt, is going to at least take that into consideration, don't you think?
Right.
I mean, Josephus was a contemporary of the fall of Jerusalem, and that's what he wrote expansively about. I think he's the single most significant source of information about the fall of Jerusalem. Does anybody actually believe that Josephus saw every single thing that he wrote about? No historian could do such a thing.
Right.
So I don't see why that would be a liability at all.
Right. To me, it seems like it's kind of shifting the goalposts. Like, you bring up because you have those people who would try to deny the historicity of Jesus, even though the majority of academia don't.
And that's right.
And kind of trying to build up a case for that rather than argue by a populum and kind of present
right.
the evidence. But they say, like, oh, he's not a contemporary. And I kind of feel
why should that? I don't know why that should matter. You mean, if that were the case, then no history could be done, realistically. Because the only history you could report on is history that you are a first-person observer of. And then someone could say, you're biased.
Right.
You have a stake in the matter, or you are deeply influenced. Look at people who and I'm going to make a judgment here, but people of ill intellectual will, all right, can, as you pointed out, move the goalposts. They can change the rules all the time instead of facing the facts. There is no good reason to mistrust Josephus in general simply because he wasn't contemporaneous with every event that he recorded about, he reported on. He seems by academic analysis, and this isn't my field, it's Mike Lacona's field. You know, I'm just making a note, Josephus, I'm going to write this down, and I'll ask Mike about it next hour. But that the consensus of history historians, the academic field, is that Josephus is a stellar source of information. Now, it turns out there's not a whole lot of information in there about Jesus, and there is one quote, there is reason to mistrust at least the way it's been delivered to us.
Right, like the interpolation. I'm familiar with that.
But. Right. And by the way, I think it's who's our friend over at, in Kalamazoo, Paul Meyer, the historian. He says that there are actually – he doesn't think that whole text that is this glowing statement about Jesus – the Messiah, the Son of God, risen from the dead, that is found in the Josephus manuscripts. He doesn't think that it is invented out of whole cloth. He thinks that it has been gussied up by some Christian scribe. So Josephus actually reported on it, but didn't say all of these extra things that were added.
Right.
And
yeah,
and apparently there are extant manuscripts that have the more pared-down version that shows that Jesus is the man of history, but it doesn't have these theological reflections in there too. So you can trust aspects even of that statement. The point I'm making here is that historians are aware when something seems amiss in a text in terms of its historical credibility, like there's maybe apparent bias or something, and they kind of sort through that. Now, sometimes something is amiss because it doesn't fit with certain maybe materialist presuppositions, and so, oh, there's a miracle, so that's not real, because those things don't happen, and
right.
That's a different problem, of course.
Right.
But I think it is fair, from what you've told me, to accuse your friend of moving the goalposts.
And, and then with the claim of saying, well, they only reported what they heard the Christians say, you don't think that that's a...
Well, he doesn't know that. He doesn't know that.
Right.
He doesn't know that at all. For one, that's only what they reported. Secondly, if that's all they reported, then why would that be a problem? I mean, why would that automatically disqualify it as reliable? You see, this is a serious bias that's coming through in this person's part, and I see this frequently. If the Bible says it, it's false when it comes
right.
to issues of history, period. There's no reason to – this is the way some people respond, not historians, by the way. But some people respond that way, and usually hacks. And then it's false, and then they say, well, then something else, some archaeological evidence comes up that bears testimony to this thing, and then they agree with it, but not because of the Bible, but because of this other archaeological evidence or this other manuscript, like Josephus, for example. That gives credibility to the event. This is just picking and choosing and treating these ancient documents in an unfair fashion. And we'll talk more about that in our second hour.
All right, thanks. I really appreciate it. It was helpful. That was something I've been kind of struggling with for a while.
Yeah, well, you keep at it, you know, and I think it's fair to say sometimes to people, you know, I think you're being intellectually dishonest.
Right.
If this person was an eyewitness to the events and they believe the events about Jesus' life, then you would say they can't report honestly about it because they have a bias. And then you say this other guy can't report about it because he wasn't there. He got his information from someone else. That's the way history is done.
Right.
By the way, all ancient history is done this way, ancient. Like when they have to infer history from tablets and not from other historians of the era, but before there were historians of the era,
mm-hmm.
They have to infer the history from all these other things.
Right.
Well, there you've got nobody that's a testimony that's a contemporary that's contemporaneous with the events, but you have maybe documents or you have stones or archaeological evidence to infer certain facts from, and that would destroy the whole historical enterprise.
Right.
So
I know for me it would seem problematic, especially it shows intellectual dishonesty is the passage where it talks about kind of in passing James's death.
Yes,
So it's like why would that just be something that he heard and recorded as history that wasn't really history. That was just something, a doctrinal. I guess, well, it's not a doctrinal belief of ours, so mm-hmm. you know, why would it be there in the text?
We actually don't have the freedom to do that, by the way. We don't have the freedom in most cases to just simply dismiss the particular details in an historical account like that from Josephus simply because we don't know where he got the information. I mean, if we did that, we would trust nobody about anything because they could always be lying. What you have to do is you have to have a little less jaundiced approach to the things that are written down, and then you have to ask yourself, and this is where whenever you have corroborating evidence, it's always helpful. But of course, we do have corroborating evidence. We have Matthew, and we have Mark, and we have Luke, and we have John. And those ought not, in fairness, they ought not be dismissed out of hand. Just because they record history that people don't like,
right.
the philosophic implications of. So, but it happens all the time, of course. Okay. Get used to it. All right, Chris?
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the call. 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to Sam in Austin. Hold on, let me find it here. It says Sam in Austin. I almost thought it said Sam Houston. Isn't that guy's name, Sam Houston, or maybe who's the guy? Isn't there a Sam in Texas history?
Yeah, Sam Houston.
Oh, Sam Houston. Oh, okay.
I'm not Sam Houston, though. He's dead.
All right, Sam from Austin, Texas.
I had a document with his name on it in the courthouse, which was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. That's great. Doesn't it kind of give you a little shiver to see one of those things?
It does.
I mean, it's just so
cool. Most of the courthouses in Texas, though, have burned down at some point in their history. So usually when you see these old documents, it's not their actual signature. But I actually saw one with Sam Houston's signature on it,
uh-huh.
which was pretty neat.
Yeah, well, I went to, of course, you've got, in San Antonio, you've got the Alamo still there, or portions mm-hmm. of it, or I know a lot of it's been reconstructed. But
the missionary part of it.
Yeah, when I was in D.C., you know, just to see the Declaration of Independence, it's pretty faded, you know. Declaration of Independence and the you know, the Constitution, whatever. The Declaration, I guess, is the thing I'm thinking about. It's pretty faded, you know, but it's still there. And it is great.
I would like to see that. I just read John Adams' biography.
Uh-huh. That's one of Melinda's favorites, by the way.
Yeah, I really like that, too. That one in 1776 by the same guy.
Yeah, that's right. So what's on your mind, Sam from Austin?
Well, I wanted to ask
Not
you
Sam
about,
Houston.
I wanted to ask you about the resurrection or the evidence for the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of naturalistic explanations out there to explain the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
one of them, I guess, the most popular one being the hallucination hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, usually in debates that I see about this issue, even whether in writing or speaking, the theist will always say, or the person defending the resurrection, will always say that you've got to come up with a naturalistic explanation that accounts for all the evidence, and the explanation has to be true. And, but it seems to me that a person could say that even if we don't happen to know what actually happened, the mere fact that it's possible that something natural happened, a person could be justified in saying that it's more likely that something natural happened than that a resurrection happened, even if they don't happen to know what actually happened.
Why would anybody claim that it's more likely that... Say again? The question I was going to ask is, why would we have to grant them to that? Even if I have no naturalistic explanation, it's more likely that there was no resurrection than there was a resurrection. Why would they say such a thing?
Because they might say that even though with each of these individual naturalistic explanations, you can find a flaw in every one of them.
Yeah.
There's one, you know, they don't all account for all the evidence.
That's
with
right.
the same amount of explanatory power.
Right. So, in other words, with each of them, it sounds like all things considered that the supernatural explanation of the resurrection seems to give a better explanation. And so, in the face of the inability to come up with a naturalistic explanation, somebody just wants to say, well, I don't have to come up with any explanation. All I have to say is it's less likely that there's a resurrection than there was no resurrection. And so, even without an explanation, I still win, basically. Is that what you're facing?
Close to that. Basically, what they're saying is that since even though each individual naturalistic explanation has less explanatory scope than the actual resurrection, they do at least show that it's possible that something natural happened.
So?
And maybe we don't know particularly what happened, But the fact that it's possible that something natural happened seems to at least give the person justification for saying that it's more likely, or at least that they're justified in believing that something natural happened, even if they don't happen to know what exactly happened.
All right. Just because it's possible
doesn't mean it's reasonable to believe.
Exactly. Thank you very much. That's precisely what I was going to say. Just because it's possible does not mean it's reasonable to believe. All kinds of things are possible. You know, so the question is, why would you go with the unknown naturalistic explanation rather than the perfectly coherent and reasonable, unless you have a bias against it, supernatural explanation, especially since it explains everything that we know about that particular event, the death and empty tomb of Jesus and the changed disciples and et cetera. Why would you do it? And here is where I think what's going on here is you got the David Hume camel sticking his nose underneath the tent,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, there's a human argument.
And he's trying to get in here. And basically the idea is, since it's never more likely that a supernatural event would take place, and it's always more likely that a natural explanation is available, then you're never justified in believing in the miracle. I mean, maybe that's kind of a hack job on Hume, but it's something along that line. Yeah,
Hume argued that it's always more likely that something natural happened. But this person is arguing not that it's always more likely that something natural happened. He's arguing that in general, as long as, you know, you have possibilities, in general, it's more likely that something
natural. But it's the same argument. It's exactly the same argument, in general, regardless. Now, let me ask you a question.
The person is not saying that, in principle, you couldn't prove something miraculous happened,
right,
which is what Hume said. This person is granting that, yeah, you could have evidence that's strong enough to believe in the
resurrection.
Right,
right.
But
still, it's trumped by this other thing, okay? So this is the point I'm making here. I think there's a deep kinship to the arguments, okay? So here's my response to that. Given all the possible places on the earth that Greg Kokel could be at any given point of time, that Greg Kokel could possibly be at any given point in time,
mm-hmm,
all right, is given that broad possibility, is anyone ever justified in believing that on Friday morning I was standing in front of Jake's bar in Olympia, Washington, in that little, you know, 100 square inches piece of real estate, given all the size of the entire earth that
sure,
I could be on.
As long as they had some reason to think you were there.
Say again?
Sure, as long as they thought there was some reason to think you were there.
Bingo, that's it. This kind of argument is deceptive because in one sense, if you're saying, well, given all the possibilities, why would anybody choose this one, which seems to be so unlikely? And the answer is because we're not just working with raw possibilities. If I mm-hmm. were to simply say, you know, what are the chances that I'd be anywhere on Earth, then, you know, then it would be pretty wide open. But if I were to say, what are the chances that I would be standing in front of Jake's if we have good reason to believe I was speaking at five different locations within 2 days right there in town? And I had a bunch of free time to walk around in the downtown sector, and I was going to have breakfast with my wife. I mean, when you add the other known details,
mm-hmm.
then that changes the probability curve massively.
Right.
And so you can't act as if these other things don't matter, and that's exactly what's happening here. It's almost like the person is saying, well, if you disregard all that other evidence that you have, then what are the chances? Well, the chances are basically nil. You'd always be justified in believing a non-supernatural event happened rather than a supernatural event because there are more non-supernatural events than otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you start factoring in all the different evidence, then the question is, given what we know, what is the most reasonable solution? And that's when explanatory power comes into play. By the way, anybody who took the approach that you just described,
mm-hmm.
and if they took that, science would never get off the ground.
How so?
Well, because it's like, what are the chances that any particular thing would happen anywhere in any particular way? What you have to do is you can't just work with broad possibilities with no observational, experimental research evidence. People come to conclusions of a scientific nature because they've gathered pieces of evidence that then require from them an explanation that has explanatory power, all right? And if it's adequate, then it's reasonable to believe that rather than some other crazy off-the-cuff thing that's unrelated to the facts in place.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm saying here. You know, if you're just starting from nowhere, fine. You know, if you said, what's the chance somebody rise from the dead? Well, pretty, you know, basically nil. But if the circumstances were that you saw the guy dead and you were there when he was buried and they put him in the ground and covered the casket, and then you came back 3 days later and the whole thing was busted wide open and the casket was empty and dirt's all over everywhere, and the body is gone, and a whole bunch of your close friends say they saw the guy that we buried just a couple of days, just down the road here at the Starbucks, for goodness sake. Well, see, doesn't that change the equation a little bit?
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. So you can't summarily dismiss all of the facts relevant to a supernatural explanation and then act like you've won the argument because it's a better chance that the non-supernatural explanation is true than the supernatural.
Well, I think in an argument like that, a person wouldn't be completely dismissing the strength of the argument for the resurrection. They would just argue that the strength for the supernatural explanation of the resurrection is not enough to overcome, you know, the prima facie view that resurrections are highly unlikely. And it's possible that something natural could have happened that we just don't know about.
Oh, yeah, okay, well then, but the kind of the point I was making about standing in front of Jake's is that all historical events taken in isolation are highly unlikely in themselves.
Right.
They are not unlikely because of, you know, the natural supernatural kind of divide, but they're certainly unlikely just as a natural event.
Yeah.
And so if you're looking at those terms, then what you've done is you've aced yourself out of drawing any conclusions about anything anymore. And that's, again, it's like the first caller mentioned, it's like moving the goal line. Mm-hmm. And this is what's being done all the time. Look, if a guy wants to believe that, that's fine. If he wants to say, I'm not persuaded, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, everybody's got to make their own decisions. But I'm not the least bit dissuaded about the compelling nature of the arguments for the resurrection because some other guy wants to dismiss a lot of the evidence as being relevant to the decision and said, no matter what you tell me, I'm just declaring it's always more likely that there is a non-supernatural event, and therefore I'm justified in believing it. This is unmitigated skepticism, it seems
to me.
Well,
like I said, he's not completely dismissing the
arguments.
He's just saying they don't rise to
I am taking that into consideration, but it turns out to be a dismissal. When he says it doesn't rise to what's necessary because it's always going to be more likely that there was no resurrection, then that is a dismissal of any evidence you could possibly give him because he's already decided that no evidence will rise to adequacy when he's considered, I think, a priori, that the non-supernatural solution is going to be better. That's my instinct about this person. So,
okay.
But people, look, at some people you can't persuade, and every person, Christian or otherwise, have to look at the evidence and ask themselves whether it seems to be persuasive taken as a whole. And I think it's eminently persuasive, partly because of the point you brought out, that it has much more explanatory power, and nothing but unmitigated skepticism will force somebody to deny that and just go with the long shot.
Well, do you think somebody would be irrational if they doubted the resurrection happened or had reservations about it?
Well, I'd want to be careful about
it. You know, it's always possible because, you know, you hear all kinds of crazy stories out there in your everyday life, you know, when you run into charismatics or whatever.
Right, right.
And you can't always explain them away, but the fact that you can't explain them away doesn't mean you're unjustified in doubting them.
No, it depends on the nature of the thing. And so sometimes the nature of the thing and the evidence that is offered is so compelling on the merits that you would be irrational to reject it.
Mm-hmm.
There's other things going on here than rationality. So, and I talk about this in the last chapter, tactics, but that'll be for another day. Sam, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, got to run to a break here, and I'll be back with more calls after this. Stay with us at Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
You're listening to Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, a tournament of thought in every show. Be sure to go to str.org for all kinds of fun stuff. 900 pages of content there. Also, if you want to see the poster from Jake's Hate Free Queer Bar, who welcomes everybody, asterisk, you have to go to my Facebook. And you can do that easily just by going there and asking to be my friend, and we'll bring you on board probably. Take a look at it. It's a lot of fun. Let's go to John in Riverside. John, thank you for calling.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for talking to me.
Sure.
I'm a little nervous, so I'm going to do my best to be coherent here.
You sound wonderful so far.
All right, thanks. I've got a couple objections to the moral argument.
All right.
I was hoping you could address them for
me. Sure.
Because I like the argument. It seems effective, but I can't use it if I don't think it's valid.
Of course.
Okay, the first objection that I have is regarding the premise that objective moral values exist.
Yeah.
Generally, the support for that I've seen is that we have a general sort of shared sense that objective moral values exist.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, right.
Okay.
It's kind of like we have a shared sense that numbers exist.
Okay. But
by the way, don't miss the significance of the comment I just offered there. It wasn't a throwaway, really. It does relate. And the point that I was making with that is simply because, in a sense, we have a shared perception of it, of a thing that is not physical, doesn't mean that we have good reason to doubt that that thing actually exists. That's not a weak kind of evidence for the thing, because that's the exact same kind of evidence that we have for mathematical relationships. We reflect on them, and rational relationships. We reflect on them, and we see them, and those who have properly functioning minds recognize them and can use them because they're real, and even though they're not physical. And so they are, I think, moral values are similar in that regard in terms of the way that we know them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, thanks.
And I listen to Bill Craig a lot, and one of the things that he says is that any argument you offer against the sense, you know, your sense of moral perception would be equally used against, say, your sense of sight.
Okay.
But my I guess it seems weak to me because excuse me. It seems weak to me because where is your sense of sight or your even perception of numbers can be verified in other ways. You know, like if I have two cans in front of me and I add a third can, I can, you know, see with my other senses, and, you know, I can verify it in other ways. And same thing with a sense of sight.
Okay, just to pause for just a moment on that one.
Okay.
Just because it can be verified, and I actually don't think you're proving, like, math in that particular instance. I think you're only exemplifying it.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't actually add up for you if you didn't have the math notions working already in your mind. So it isn't like that's a scientific test proving math. It is just a physical exemplification of math, which exemplification you could do just as easily in your mind. If you're a blind person, you could still imagine objects, and you could see them clustered, and you could see, you know, 3 times 3 is 9, you know. So it can be exemplified in physical and non-physical ways. So that does, in my mind, doesn't at all strengthen the notion that math is something, you know, reliable, where morality is not. I still think it's pretty much the same kind of thing. But let me just grant that the math notion may be stronger.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that the moral notion is weak enough not to be taken seriously as objectively real.
Okay, well, let me just, you know, cut to the chase then.
Okay. Yeah, we're a little tight on time. Sorry.
Okay. Is there an additional way of establishing that moral values exist other than our shared perception of them?
No, there is no other way except for if you want to take revelation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if God says they exist, I mean, that's one kind of argument. It's probably not going to be any more persuasive to somebody who denies their existence. But if you have good reason that God is the one who is speaking, and he is the one who grounds such things, in fact, even by definition, one could say that objective moral values are those things that God requires of us, then that would be one way of demonstrating, at least in principle, that they exist. But it's like, and I talked about this on Friday morning at South Puget Sound Community College in the ethics class there. I said, the way we know things exist is by perceiving them. And when we want others to know what we know about, oftentimes what we do is we point at them. So when I want somebody to believe in the existence of an elephant, what I can do is show him an example of an elephant. There, that's it right there. See, there it is. Well, we do that with physical things, and we see it with our eyes, but we can do that with non-physical things just as easily, and we see it with another aptitude or capability, and that is our moral perception. Or when we say I love my wife, well, you can't see love, but I can point to this thing, and there is a shared perception of the concept. People aren't skeptics about love. They say, well, there's no such thing as love. Where is it? Put it on the table here so I can see it. The very same thing is done in that kind of thing. So we can see in different ways. And we point to things that we either see or don't see to show their existence by using language as a pointing tool. And that's exactly what we're doing here. It's really no different. Now, I don't know if a person really wants to be a skeptic about these things, there's probably no way to shake them loose of it except for to point out the fact that when they are not guarding their turf, they talk as if morals are real all the time. And in fact, it is not possible to have language for any length of time about anything. You just listen to anybody without having moral terms creep into the discussion. And this is further evidence that they see just as well as everyone else moral truths, and that's why they are using words to point to them in explicit and implicit ways. I argue that there's nobody who's really a relativist, and it's very easy to demonstrate this from their own conversation. So I don't know. I can point at morality in this way using moral intuition. That's the standard way of proving its existence, but it's the same way you prove the existence of just about anything else in our common experience. And I think Bill Craig is right in this regard. It's a reasonable way to demonstrate the existence of a thing, and there's no reason to be skeptical of it just because it's immaterial. That's a materialist bias.
All right. Do we have time for my second objection?
Can I ask you a favor, John? Could you call back next week and we'll pursue this more? If we had another hour, I could do this. I have to get to the last caller, but I would love to talk about this more. It's an important topic, okay?
All right.
Okay, we'll talk then. Thanks for the call. Let's go quickly to Dan. Dan in La Mirada, thanks for the call.
Hey, Greg, I love the deal with Jake's up there in Seattle. I'm going to try and get a picture of that and use that.
Well, you can download it from my Facebook if you want.
Yeah. If I wasn't homebound with waiting for back surgery, I would fly up there and go in with a Christian.
Well, you don't want to make trouble. I didn't do it, you know.
I didn't put it on you. I said I would do it.
I don't know that would be a good thing to do.
Enjoy the lawsuit.
Okay.
Anyway, the reason I called.
Yeah, real quickly, we got about a minute and a half to go.
Right. It's one thing to beat someone or, you know, tell someone they're going to hell in the waiting line at a checkout. You don't do that. You know, then you can only give them a stone. But why, if you haven't, are speaking before Emergent or anybody else, if you have an in and they graciously give you and you tell them the reason why, and the bottom line, you're up there for anything, is the gospel. And everything else, every explanation flows from the gospel. Why would you not first give them the gospel as the explanation and the ways that it flows out?
Let me answer that quickly because we're almost out of time.
My last thought.
Keep talking, I won't be able to answer you. I'm sorry. I just got about 30 seconds.
So the
answer is I don't think that the only reason that I'm in front of an audience is just to get the gospel out. So we have a difference of opinion there.
Amen.
I'd have to explain it at a different time. However, the fact is I do get the gospel out when I think it's appropriate and when it fits. I gave two talks at the South Puget Sound Community College, one in the ethics class in which I didn't give the gospel, the other one to a much larger audience on the problem of evil in which I did. And I cast it this way. God has a rescue plan with regards to the problem of evil, and here it is. And the last item was he sent his son to die for sinful men so that they would experience mercy instead of judgment for their crimes against him. So there was a circumstance where it was actually quite appropriate to the topic for me to work the gospel in, and I did it. And
why
often
not at the college, though?
Pardon me? Yes, it was at the college.
Well, no, I mean the other one, the Emergent place.
Oh, well, the Emergent, these were Christians. I was teaching on the Bible, never read a Bible verse. It was a different topic.
Oh, Emergent Christians. I love it.
Yeah, they were. It was wonderful. It was called Reality Church there in Olympia.
I heard about the Reality Church, Greg. Well, difference of opinion, bud.
All right, great. Thanks for the call, Dan. Hour number two coming up with Mike Lacona. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
All right, friends, this is hour number two at Stand to Reason. And starting next week, of course, hour number two will be hour number one because we're going to be starting an hour earlier and going three full hours on our show. And at least here in Southern California, I'm not sure about the other network stations, but be sure to tune in just in case an hour earlier. About a year ago or so, I did some work with Brett Kunkel from Stand to Reason in Colorado and doing some speaking there. And I think the night before our event, got together at somebody's home and I was sitting on a table with some people that I just met and didn't. You know, I recognize some of the names, but really didn't have a lot of background in my mind. But, you know, as it is, and you get together as professionals, sometimes you knock around some issues that have come up and that you're curious about. And I always like to pick other people's minds, especially when they might know more about a thing than I do. And there are a lot of people like that. And so one of my new friends I just met was sitting across the table. And I said, by the way, I just got this call on the radio show about these dying and rising messiahs, Osiris or something like this, this Egyptian guy, and I kind of tossed out this thing. And do you know anything about it? And the guy across the table for me just calmly and patiently and in a well-organized way, just trotted out about 15 minutes of facts and figures and information. And I was really, really impressed. In fact, that wasn't the only question I asked. I just happened to bring up something else. And there he was, Johnny on the spot with the answer on that one. And I thought either I said to the group there and to him, I said, you know, either I have just, touched on the two questions you did your PhD thesis on, or, man, you really know a lot about a lot of stuff. And it turns out the second is true. His name is Mike Lacona, and he's a New Testament historian, PhD in New Testament studies from the University of Pretoria. It's like he's debated just about everybody of significance here. Shabir Ali, the leading Muslim apologist, Dan Barker, atheist, Richard Carrier, atheist, Bart Ehrman, author of Misquoting Jesus. So he's been around a lot, and we've gotten to be good friends in the last year. I got him on the show with me today. Mike, it's great to have you on board.
Well, thanks, Greg. You're really kind. I appreciate it.
Well, look, you know, we met that day, and, you know, we're sitting there having Mexican food at somebody's house, and, you know, I just kind of recognized your name because I know you've done the work with Gary Habermas and on the resurrection, co-author of The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. And I just found out, by the way, you were the recipient of Christianity Today's 2005 Award of Merit for some of your work. So congratulations for that, like 4 years later. But I was just so impressed by your ability to just bring it all together. And it was really super. I did happen to touch, though, with that question about the dying and rising messiahs and that whole issue about the person of Jesus and the resurrection. I did happen to kind of hit the epicenter of the bullseye there on your area specialty, didn't I?
Well, yeah, in a sense so, because I have specialized in everything related to the resurrection of Jesus. I wouldn't even say everything related, but a lot that's related to the question of did Jesus rise from the dead, and of course the question of dying and rising gods is part and parcel of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Mike, that there's been, just as you kind of been watching things for the last few years, kind of an increase of public skepticism about Jesus as an historical figure?
Oh, sure. Public, yes. Scholarship, no.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, I could give you a ton of different quotes from scholars from all different theological camps that basically say it's lunacy to say that Jesus never existed. In fact, that's pretty much what Rudolf Bultmann said in the 70s, that one would have to be a lunatic in order to deny that Jesus was the founder of the religion of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have a lot of internet skeptics where your only credential has to be that you breathe in order to post on the internet, and you've got some folks like this who are posting on the internet. They think their arguments are good. Scholars pretty much are just rolling their eyes and laughing at them. I mean, you could probably name all the scholars in the world who believes that Jesus never existed on a single hand. You've got people like Richard Carrier who's saying that it's more likely than not. Bob Price, I don't know that he's actually come out and said that Jesus never existed, but it seems like he leans in that direction. I don't know of too many scholars other than those two. Well, Michael Martin, he is an atheist philosopher.
Right, or at Boston University. He actually denies the existence of Jesus?
I believe so,
or
yes.
Or is a skeptic
in
about it?
The Case Against Christianity.
Bertrand Russell.
In there, he says that, G.A. Wells says that Jesus didn't exist, and he says he tends to agree with Wells, if I remember him correctly.
Yeah. That's Michael.
He said Wells' thesis is not widely accepted, so he wasn't going to promote it throughout his book.
Okay, so that's Michael Martin. Didn't I think Bertrand Russell at least made the comment that there were, in his book, Why I'm Not a Christian, made the comment that he didn't. You know, he had no conviction that Jesus was a real historical character. So I thought that was a terrible mistake for a guy of the stature of Bertrand Russell to make in that book. But in any event, I was at Purdue in January, and I gave a talk there to about 1,200 students. It was a packed-out crowd in freezing weather, and it was great to see them all come out. But there's a whole section there of skeptics from the Skeptic Society. You know, they're all sitting together with their T-shirts on and everything, and I got a lot of pushback from them on this very issue. And so let me just – I just want to underscore something that you just mentioned. I want a little more feedback on it. What I said to the group then in response to some of these challenges was, on balance, historians accept the primary source documentation of Jesus' life, that would be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as historically valid sources of information. That doesn't mean they believe everything that's in them, but they do not reject them as sources of bona fide history about the person of Jesus.
Oh, that would be completely accurate.
Yeah. That's something.
What you just said, mm-hmm. what you told them would have been completely mm-hmm. accurate in terms of where New Testament scholarship is on the Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they would even go beyond that, I think. New Testament scholarship is, although I'd say that the majority of New Testament scholars out there probably are not Christians, as you and I would define Christians.
Right, uh-huh.
There is more of a move toward the right than where scholars were, let's say, in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
where the majority view amongst them was that the Gospels were of a specific genre, literary type, that they were mythical. They were very unique in a genre to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But since Richard Burridge's book, and then I think it came out in 1992, What Are the Gospels? And then the revised edition in something like 2003,
mm-hmm.
2004, scholarship has now moved to the other direction, to where they're seeing that the Gospels are Greco-Roman biographies,
mm-hmm.
and that they certainly intend to communicate history.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right in that they wouldn't grant everything within the Gospels. Of course, they would reject the miracles and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, your skeptical scholars. But they would still say, just as you said, that the Gospels are certainly primary sources about Jesus that report a lot of historical things about him accurately.
What of the challenge that I hear all the time? It comes up on the show, gosh, it seems almost like every month I hear something along this line, that you can't trust the Gospels because they were written by Christians.
Well, I'd say give me a reason. Well, you know, why can't I trust
mm-hmm.
them? So what if they're written by Christians? If we're going to say that, then we're going to have to say that a Jew could not write anything about the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
We would have to say that a feminist has no right teaching about feminism.
Mm.
A homosexual should not be out there. We should trust nothing that they would have to say about
mm-hmm.
gay rights. And, of course, you know, that's not going to go over in a liberal institution, will
that's
it now?
That's right.
In fact, as historian Thomas Haskell, he's a philosopher of history, and he was writing in History and Theory, perhaps the only journal out there for philosophers of history that actually talk about the philosophy of history
mm-hmm.
and exclusively about it. You know, he said that if we're going to throw someone out because they're biased, then you would immediately have to deport from the practice of history a number of recent presidents of the American or the Organization of American Historians.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that this bias thing is a little bit ambiguous, because it strikes me, Mike, that bias could be of two sorts. One would be a bias that is, you have a point of view. And a lot of people have a point of view. I think the point that you're making is just about everybody who's writing anything about anything has a point of view, which is why they're writing about it. If people didn't have a stake of some sort, they probably wouldn't have taken up the task to begin with. But there's a difference between a bias in which you have a point of view and a bias that you can demonstrate has actually distorted the facts.
Mm.
And some people presume simply because you have a stake, that would be bias number one, that you have actually are guilty of bias number two, of distortion. And that strikes me as a separate thing that you have to demonstrate.
Mm. That's such a good point you make, Greg. I mean, it's kind of like, let's go back to the Holocaust now. And certainly a Jewish historian writing on the Holocaust would have reason, would be biased, of course.
Mm.
And especially if his family died in the death camps.
Biased in the first sense of the word.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They would have a stake in this game, and they would want to see that the story got told, and that the world, hopefully that this would contribute so that the world would take action so that this kind of atrocity would never occur
mm-hmm.
again. So, yes, there is the type 1 bias at stake.
And they're trying to persuade to a certain end and have people change their actions or something as a result.
Absolutely.
So they have an agenda, one could also say.
Absolutely. And that's okay. I mean, and look, if Jesus rose from the dead, if he was who he claimed to be, and I know we can't in history. You can't presuppose that in your investigation. But we certainly could say that if he was who he claimed to be, and he actually did rise from the dead, then who can blame the early Christians and the gospel authors for writing about him and trying to promote and persuade others to believe in him?
Right, right.
So, and let's not forget that everyone is biased. No one escapes it. In fact, Gert Ludemann, a member of the Jesus Seminar, he's an atheist New Testament scholar. In his book, The Resurrection of Christ, 2004, published by Prometheus, he comes out and he says that his reason for writing, he wants to persuade Christians to leave the faith. Well, that's an agenda, isn't it? And the guy is certainly biased against Christianity. So does that mean that we throw out everything that Ludemann has to say? Well, I think that that's insane.
Right, right.
What bias simply means, as N.T. Wright said, is that bias only tells us that we have to be careful about, as we read through the author, we be careful and we're aware of that bias as we're reading it, and we're aware of our own. And
right.
Most people aren't even aware of their own. Skeptics don't think that they have any bias.
That's right.
They have an anti-theological bias.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I have some notes here. Now I'm looking for them. I actually put them away because I realized I probably wouldn't be talking about this tonight. Oh, here it is. New Quest for Historical Jesus Draws Skeptics and Scholars. And I'm sure you know about this. These are the guys... let's see. A new group of historians, biblical scholars, and theologians have embarked on the quest for the historical Jesus to objectively determine what can be reliably recovered about him. And this claim here is that this is going to be, let's see, Joseph Hoffman is involved with this. They want to do this project in the committee, let's see, Committee for the Scientific Examination of Religion. I don't know. I'm just skimming this document here, but these are the guys that when I look at their names and everything, I realize they really represent the far left in terms of their own contribution to the field. And I don't mean to dismiss them as that, but they are claiming now that they are going to give a scientific, unbiased kind of analysis of the Jesus of history, you know. And it's always kind of makes me chuckle, and I'll have more to say about this maybe in a different day. But, you know, because I know what scientific means. It means a materialistic analysis.
Right.
Yes. So, you know, these are – everybody comes to this game with a set of presuppositions that in some way influence it, don't they?
You're absolutely correct about that, Greg. You know, it sounds a whole lot like what we read in the books by the Jesus Seminar, you know, the five Gospels and the Acts of Jesus, and they come out in there and they say that they're objective and they're scholarly and they're not too far to the left or to the right, and of course everybody laughs at that. A lot of scholars, and I mean, I'm not, you know, I have a fresh PhD here. I'm sorry, let me just say, I am a fresh PhD. I can say that in talking to very seasoned, some of the top New Testament scholars in the world, members of the Society for New Testament Studies, which is the most elite group of New Testament scholars in the world, they say that a lot of times when they get together, they just laugh when they talk about the Jesus Seminar.
Yeah.
Because these guys, a lot of them just can't, most of them can't be taken seriously, and they're not at all objective or unbiased. They are almost as far to the left as you can go. Now, that's not all of them, but it's many of them.
Mike, why is it, you mentioned earlier, you kind of weighed, you know, proved my comment as being, you know, accurate in terms of what the field says, that historians characteristically take the Gospels as reliable historical sources, even though they don't believe every detail in there, because they do have a materialistic point of view, and so they're going to be understandably, given that view, very skeptical of the supernatural claims. All the other stuff they see as as sound reflection of history. Why is it that what are the reasons that these historians take the Gospels seriously, even though they don't? And we understand why they don't accept the supernatural. What is it about the Gospels that impresses them as being reliable sources of information about the man Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, I guess there'd be a number of things about him.
How about this, Mike? I just realized I'm against a break here.
Okay.
So why don't we pick up on that question right after we return from the break? How's that sound?
Sure, sounds good.
My guest is Mike Lacona. He's the author of Paul Meets Muhammad, A Christian-Muslim Debate on the Resurrection. He co-authored The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus with Gary Habermas, a recipient of Christianity Today's 2005 Award of Merit. It's a great book that if you really want to get kind of a nice, concise analysis of the resurrection arguments. We'll be back with Mike in just a moment talking about Jesus, the Messiah, and we'll be getting into some of those so-called dying and rising Messiah myths that many think Jesus is an example of. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kokel back at you here at Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday here on Stand to Reason, and with my new buddy Mike Lacona, giving you a piece of his mind. And his mind is bigger than mine on this issue, so that's why I have him on. We're talking about the historicity of the Gospels and Jesus the Messiah, and we're kind of we'll be getting to things like the Zeitgeist movie, which kind of claims that Jesus is just another myth of the dying and rising Messiahs. Mike, I'd ask you a question just a moment ago about the way historians, and here would be the in a sense the qualified historians or the real historians, those people are really who are actually making a contribution to their field and are members of the professional societies that these kinds of academics belong to. As a rule, on balance, they trust the Gospels as sound history, even though they don't trust every single thing that's in there, particularly the supernatural events. And the question I asked Mike was, what are the things about the Gospels that make them believe that that they're recording reliable history?
Well, let's start with some of the criteria for authenticity that biblical scholars often use when it comes to the sayings and deeds of Jesus. In fact, even the radical fellows of the Jesus Seminar employ a lot of these. Well, I think one of the interesting and most easily understood would be the criterion of embarrassment. So That would be that someone would not make up something and put it in the text if it's potentially embarrassing and discrediting.
Mm-hmm.
For example, all four Gospels report that Jesus had brothers and sisters. And, mm-hmm. in fact, Mark and John report that none of Jesus' brothers believed in him. Well, this would have been very embarrassing. You would have made something like that up.
Mm-hmm.
Someone could turn around and say, well, gee, you know, if Jesus couldn't even convince his own brothers, why should I be convinced?
Right.
So
I'm thinking of all the times, too, that the disciples just look like pure, complete boneheads, you know?
Exactly. I mean, what do you have with Peter? Here he is, the leader of the church, And you have the guy, instead of building this guy up, Mark, which is almost certainly based on the memoirs of Peter, mm-hmm. most New Testament scholars would agree with that.
Because Mark was a companion of Peter, apparently.
Yeah, a lot of them believe that's disagreed upon. I mean, I think the evidence for it is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But I would agree with you on that. Mark was a companion of Peter. I think there's some decent evidence for that. But certainly that, Mark had Peter's memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And he got him from Peter personally. Now, what is debated is whether he wrote it with Peter there or whether he wrote it after Peter's death.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. He was a traveling companion of Peter. And so here we have in this gospel, which is based on Peter's memoirs, saying that he has Jesus saying to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan,"
yeah.
and denying him three times. I mean, you're just not going to make up something to diss the very leader you want people to follow.
So basically what the historians are doing is they're looking at these ancient documents that record details about the life of Jesus of Nazareth in this case, and they're asking the question, what reason would anyone have in these individual cases to manufacture all these details? And when you see in these documents these embarrassing details about the very people who are carrying on the message, it strikes one as unlikely that these things would be fabricated by these people. We would expect something entirely different. And this is one thing that gives the gospel accounts their credibility with historians.
Right. And that's exactly right, Greg. And, you know, I've heard some people sometimes come back to me and said, maybe they just, when they were writing this, they realized that would give a tone of credibility to it. And so that's why they put these embarrassing things. And I said, wait a minute. You know, in the first century, there was no committee for the misleading of future historians.
Right, that's right.
In the 21st century. So, no, that's not really...
I had somebody once say to me, well, they knew that they would become famous in history, and so that's why they were willing to die for a lie, because then their name would live on in history, you know, and everybody would make a big deal. Of course, nobody at that time had, apart from their convictions about God's power to keep the church alive, they didn't have any knowledge that this thing was going to survive. All forces from a natural perspective were against them. So that's another one of these kind of silly explanations.
Well, I agree with you. And, you know, if we're talking about one person, or maybe two, you might be able to get that. I mean, you've got Lucian in the middle of the second century talking about the passing of Peregrinus, he writes. And, you know, this is probably what we have with him. He wanted to be famous, and mm-hmm. he got caught up in people looking at him as famous, and he ends up committing suicide by jumping into this big fire.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you're going to have that with a group of people knowing that they're going to die and go through all of that for a lie,
right?
Something
mm-hmm.
they know is false. You might do it for something that's false, but you believe it's true,
mm-hmm.
like Muslim terrorists
right.
today.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to die horrible deaths watching all of you do it. All your colleagues go through it, and you know, hey, take me too, when you know you're dying for something that is a lie.
By the way, this is a point that sometimes people get confused on, detractors, because they think you won't die for a lie. And they say a lot of people died for a lie. And they miss the point that you just made, Mike, that the issue here is that if it's a lie, the people that are telling the lie know it's a lie.
Right.
And that's the kind of person that won't die for a lie, the guy that knows it's a lie. And that would be the thing we'd be facing if these gospel accounts were fabrications of the people who wrote them. Well, you mentioned the principle or the criterion of embarrassment. What other criteria that historians bring to the table that are especially important with regards to the reliability of the gospel accounts?
Well, you would have the criterion of multiple independent reports. And you got to put independent in there, because just because you have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John doesn't mean that they're independent. In fact, a lot of scholars believe, and I think to a degree they're correct, that Matthew and Luke had access to Mark and they used him.
Mm-hmm.
To the degree that they had Mark and used him, they're not independent of Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And if Matthew and Luke had another source that would be called Q,
mm-hmm.
if they had Q, then that would be another source. But that would also show that Mark and Q are two separate sources now.
That's right. That's right. Uh-huh.
And then you've got John, and most scholars believe that John was independent of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So that gives you a third source.
Right.
And then most scholars recognize that Matthew has his own material that's unique to his gospel, that
mm-hmm.
he probably got from different communities that he was privy to be in, who heard Jesus, that perhaps Luke wasn't.
Right. Just for clarification to the listeners, Mike, Q would be that material that is in, Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. And so it looks
right.
like they had another source they drew from. But as you point out, if that's the case, then we have at least two independent sources. You have Mark and Q,
mm-hmm.
Quell, the source. In addition to that, you have that unique stuff that's in Matthew and the unique stuff that's in Luke. So everybody makes a contribution that is unique in some way, even though there's material that crosses over each other, right?
Right.
That's the point.
And yeah, John. So we have at least five independent sources
mm-hmm.
on Jesus. So that's pretty good.
Oh, yeah. And also you got Paul, because he's given historical information in his work. So, okay, so you got embarrassment. You got multiple independent reports. Any other thing that stands out for you as one of the reasons that historians take the gospel seriously?
Sure. You've got early reports.
Mm.
Mark is going to be early. If there's a Q, the source material from Q would be early. The verse says, ask and it shall be given, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is word for word in Matthew and Luke.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can see that probably comes from a single source. So
mm-hmm.
you've got, let's say, the hypothetical Q, you've got Mark, and those are early. And when you look in Mark...
When you say early, how early are you speaking here, probably? Round numbers.
You know, scholars just date them differently, and the truth of the matter is we really don't know when they were written, except that they were written in the first century. But let's just take the standard dating of, let's say, Mark, 65 to 70. Now, some even skeptics, like James Crossley at Sheffield, puts Mark in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So we just really don't know. But let's just take the standard one that even, you know, most, say, moderate scholars
mm-hmm.
and everybody go by. With at least, and that would be 65 to 70. So now we're talking about 35 to 40 years after Jesus, and that is pretty short compared to most other things written in antiquity in terms
mm-hmm.
of biographies.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you an example, you've got Augustus. He's the regarded as the greatest of the Roman emperors, of the Caesars. He was the emperor at the time of Jesus' birth.
Right.
And here you've got seven chief sources that mention Augustus, two when he was a child, but they stop. They die by the time he's 19 or 20. And then you've got a funerary inscription written around the time of his death, but that's only 4,000 words. And that talks about his adulthood and what he achieved as emperor. So that leaves you with four other sources written on Augustus. And Plutarch is the earliest of those, and it's written... He writes about 90 years after Augustus's death. The others, between 100 and 200 years later. Now, when you consider that, 35 to 65 years for four biographies being written on Jesus doesn't look so bad now.
Yeah, especially with the detail that they each give. Which detail, a lot of it, as I understand it and I look at it, suggests that these writers must have been writing much more closely to the time of the events themselves and not just kind of scrabbling around for information. You've got this massive detail of all these particular events that is compelling. Hey, I'm curious. I don't know if I've ever asked you this, Mike, but, John A.T. Robinson dates, and he's not an evangelical New Testament scholar, but he dates all of the New Testament books before 70 A.D. because none of them mention this unbelievably significant event, the destruction of the temple and the by Titus of Rome in 70 A.D. So, it would be hard to imagine that any Christian writer would not mention this destruction of the Jews who rejected their Messiah on their view. if, in fact, it had happened. Do you think this is a compelling argument for early dating of the New Testament documents?
I do. I like it. In fact, yeah, I mean, I've got his book on my shelf. I think his argument's decent. I don't know that it's been addressed at length or refuted in any sense. Mm-hmm. Very few people have commented on it, to my knowledge.
But I don't even know why people would even date. And I think he says this in his book. What are the reasons to put it later? You've got this compelling reason to date him earlier. What is the reason to put it later? And in almost every case, as I recall, he says it's you've got a certain bias against the historical reliability of these documents that forces you to put it later because the scholars before you did so for that reason. And so reversing the trend has been hard, but there doesn't seem to be any good arguments to put them late. And this is a very powerful and compelling argument to date the documents. Documents early. And by the way, if these are done by if the latest is done before 70 AD, then and there is some literary relationship, especially with Mark being the most primitive, that means that's going to push Mark more into the 40s or early 50s, like you mentioned that one scholar suggested.
Well, even Donald Guthrie in his New Testament intro talks about with Matthew how there's reason to believe that Matthew is addressing a lot of issues that took place in the 50s and early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the case, then Matthew's writing during that period of time. And if Matthew, if most scholars are correct in saying that Matthew wrote prior to Luke, and if Luke is writing, you know, let's just take the common argument that's given for an early dating of Luke. You start off with Acts, of course, and that ends with Paul still in prison.
Right.
And, you know, this destruction of Jerusalem hasn't occurred because it stops at around 61 to 62 A.D. So
right.
Luke is writing before then.
It kind of just stops abruptly, too. It's like there's nothing else to report, so he kind of just stops, which suggests that the book of Acts is written right around that time. Right.
That's correct. Now some, like Ben Witherington and Craig Keener, both of whom are tremendous scholars and evangelicals, argue that they still think that Acts was probably written around the year 80, and they say that he's not necessarily following Paul in terms of a biography here, and what he's doing is he's doing more, reporting more of the acts of the Holy Spirit through Acts, and so he's not so much concerned about Paul's death there, and he just stops at that point. So it does seem kind of abrupt. I agree
yeah,
with
but
you.
I tell you,
I'm not an Acts specialist, so
yeah, but
it is a little confusing to
Mike,
me.
I'm surprised that Ben Witherington would say that. I don't, you know, this isn't my field so much. You know, I listen to guys like you and Ben and others, but I am that just doesn't seem to be compelling to me in the slightest. When you figure that the in the book of Acts and the work of the Holy Spirit, the person who the Holy Spirit worked through most powerfully was this magnificent apostle named Paul, and to think that if Paul had been dead by the time the Acts was written and the temple had been destroyed and the writer of Acts never mentions this, even if his emphasis was the work of the Holy Spirit, that strikes me as really odd.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not an Acts specialist, but it seems to me that Luke would want to at least throw something in there suggesting that the temple had been destroyed, or at least fast forward to where this happened and comment on it.
Well, you were starting to develop the argument that Luke was early because at the end of Acts, it looks like Acts ends at about 62, so right around then Acts was written, and then the gospel comes before that, right?
Correct. And then Matthew would come before that, and if Matthew's commenting on events that are occurring or addressing things somewhere in the 50s or early 60s, you know, that's putting Matthew early and then Mark before that. So, I think that there are decent arguments for an earlier dating of the Gospels. I mean, it really doesn't matter a whole lot because either way, even the standard dating of 35 to 65 years is still pretty good compared to others we have.
Yeah.
But if you have early dating, then it sounds even better. And the traditional authorship of the Gospels, I think that we're on good grounds in holding that thing, contrary to the claims of others that say that, you know, we don't know who wrote those Gospels, like Bart Ehrman.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that sometimes Christians miss the point here, and this is whether they're discussing this kind of issue or even like atheism, whatever. They think sometimes we act as if just because the other side can come up with possible scenarios that might be true, that we are not kind of within our rights to go with the most, with our view, when, especially when it's most reasonable. You know, maybe in the debate about whether God exists or not, maybe the whole universe kind of come out of nothing. But why would anybody want to bank on that when it seems so utterly unlikely and the God alternative is so much more reasonable? And the same thing true here. I mean, well, maybe they were all written late in the first century, but we got better arguments that they were early, so why not go with those? We're really within our rights to do so. Listen, we got to go to break here, Mike, and when we come back, I want to talk about you know, the Zeitgeist Project and some of this dying, rising Messiah myths that people talk about and used to explain away the gospel accounts of Jesus of Nazareth. So we'll cover that when we return. My guest, Mike Lacona, author of The Case for the Resurrection of Christ and a specialist in this area. So we'll be finding out what he has to say about these myths when I return here on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on Is the Supernatural Real? Is Jesus a Prophet or the Son of God? Do All Roads Lead to God? Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason, friends. Scratching your mind where it itches every Sunday, usually 3 to 5, but starting next weekend, at least in Southern California, we'll be starting at 2 o'clock, so mark your calendars. We've got an added hour, and it's not just for next week, but we will be continuing with a three-hour show after that, and the first hour will be Scott Klusendorf. Now, I'll be flying in from Indiana that morning, and we were talking to Scott, and Scott said, well, if you don't make your flight, just patch me in, and I'll just do the show for you, which he's fully capable of doing. But look forward to our show starting at 2 o'clock next week. Talking with Mike Lacona now. He's the author of Paul Meets Muhammad, Christian-Muslim Debate on the Resurrection. By the way, was your debate with Shabir Ali a difficult debate, Mike?
No, it wasn't. I was expecting a really difficult one. In fact, I prepared no less than 70 hours a week for 4 months for that debate.
Wow.
Because it was my second debate.
Uh-huh.
And yet I knew that Shabir probably debated every month and had done so for several years. So I knew I was taking on a pro here. And again, it was only my second debate. So I took it very seriously and prepared for it. And I was expecting all of this a very difficult time. But no, I thought it, he was easy, very easy. And it was kind of disappointing. So I figured, you know, all this studying I've done, I just can't let it go to waste here.
Yeah.
So what I did was I constructed a debate of how I thought it was going to go with Shabir, and put it in a fictional setting and made it Paul meets Muhammad.
No kidding, that's pretty
so
cool.
That's how that book came about.
I didn't realize that was the genesis of it. Well, you know, you're an example of the adage the Marines train by, and I have it in the last chapter of the tactics book. And that is, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. So good for you. Listen, are you familiar with the Zeitgeist Project or the Zeitgeist movie?
I've never seen it. What I have heard, though, is that it it addresses it relies primarily on Acharya's work, The Christ Conspiracy, the greatest story ever ever sold. And I was asked to debate her, I think it was back in 2000, and I accepted. She declined, so she was on a radio show for a couple hours, and then two nights later, I was on the show for a couple of hours, and then they asked me to put it. So I had to read her book, and I, you know, provide critique, and I did. And they asked me to put it in writing, and so I put it. I got it all in 20 pages single spaced, and then she responded with a 10 page single spaced, and then I responded with a 20 page single spaced again. And I mean, her stuff is just utterly trash. I mean, there's nothing academic about it. She puts all these things on there. They're not documented. I mean, she says they are, but what she does is she cites other people, none of whom are scholars, hardly any of them are scholars. It's just lunacy. And I checked out some of her sources and emailed them, and they said, no, I never said that. That's not what I mean.
Let's deal with the broad question that the Zeitgeist movie brings up, and that has to do with the way of explaining away the Gospels by comparing the Gospel accounts of Jesus as a kind of a dying God and a rising God with these other myths from the past or with mystery religions of the time to show that these are – Jesus is just another example of this. What is the argument, and who are the main contenders for these ancient myths that they compare to Jesus of Nazareth?
For a long time, I'd say at the beginning of the 20th century, you had a guy come out, I think his name was Frazier, around 1906, something like that, and he came out with a book that talked about these dying and rising gods. And he appealed to the Semitic gods, these people like Baal, Adonis, Mithras, and so forth, and said that, hey, they died and they rose from the dead, and see, Jesus is just more of the same here. It's cut from the same cloth. Christianity borrowed from these religions, and they all predate Christianity. So that's kind of what the argument is.
And what say you to the argument?
Well, boy, there's a lot to get into, and Gary Habermas wrote a fine article several years ago called, "Dying and Rising Gods in Non-Christian Religions," and he showed that all of these post-date the writing of the Gospels. They don't predate it. The religions are actually older than Christianity, but the stories about the gods dying and rising don't occur until after the Gospels were written. And so it'd be difficult for Christianity to borrow from them. It's anachronistic.
Right.
The most recent comprehensive treatment on this is by a senior Swedish scholar named T.N.D. Bettinger in a book called The Riddle of Resurrection, Dying and Rising Gods in the Ancient Near East. And Bettinger says, comes right out and he says that the consensus of scholars today, nearly universal consensus of scholars, is that there are no dying and rising gods that predate Christianity. So, differing from Frazier's work in the early 20th century, the consensus of scholarship has now shown that these post-date Christianity. But Mettinger says that he's going to take exception with this. And he says, I realize that almost all the scholars who study this say that there are none that predate Christianity, but I think that there are at least three and maybe as many as five. You know, when he talks about these, it's rather interesting. Like one of the ones he gives, I think we were discussing this at the table.
Yeah, and that dinner where we met.
Baal. And we've all heard of Baal. And the story of this is he's got a nemesis named Mott. And one day they're kind of talking each other, trash-talking each other, and Mott says, okay, Baal, well, you're the storm god up there. You're in charge of the wind and the rain and the lightning. Why don't you just leave all that behind and come on down here to the underworld, and I'll show you who's your daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Baal says, no problem, and he leaves it all behind. He goes down to the underworld, and Mott swallows him. Well, the parents, mother and dad of Baal, realize that he's gone, and because it stopped raining. And so Baal's mom goes down to the netherworld and sees Mott and says, you swallowed my son. Now spit him out. And he says, no. And so she beats him up and finally says, all right, I'll let him go. Just leave me alone and I'll let him go.
I guess Mott now knows the answer to the question, who's your mama, huh?
There you go. So she returns up to the world. And a few months later, Baal's dad says, well, our son Baal is alive again. And guess how he knew?
It's raining.
It's raining. There was no post-mortem appearance or anything like that. And, of course, the scholars recognize that what we have here is something that has to do with the agriculture, the changing of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like when you and I were kids and we said to our parents, you know, or Mom, well, why is it thundering? And she said, because the angels are bowling in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the summer, the kids would say, Mom, why has it stopped raining? Why is it so dry? And then they tell them the story about Mott and Baal and what happened.
Right.
Well, that would happen every summer. So it wasn't something that was seriously believed to have been true. And, there's no post-mortem appearances. There are no eyewitnesses to this. It's
well,
in the
what I'm struggling, Mike, to try to find anything that is parallel, except for in this most vague sense of something's gone and then it comes back, you know,
yep.
Parallel to Jesus, because the accounts of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus actually bear no resemblance to this kind of thing, hardly whatsoever. So I don't know how someone could properly conclude that Jesus' life comes from this particular myth.
Well, you know, Menninger would agree with you, too. In fact, he has an appendix, and he says, okay, if we have these three and maybe as many as five that predate Christianity, what does this say about Jesus could have influenced?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where Menninger is, whether he's a Christian or, mm-hmm. or what he is. I emailed him once. He never got back to me because I was curious about these
mm-hmm.
things. But he says in regards to Jesus, he said, hey, you know, this is different. This is not tied to the agricultural cycles.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We actually have eyewitnesses, people who really believe that he had risen and had appeared personally to them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there's just not enough here to say, the Christians could not have been influenced by these to make up the story about the resurrection of Jesus. The riddle remains.
What about I think we talked about the Egyptian story as well, and I want to say Osiris, but maybe I've got the name wrong.
No, I think you're right with Osiris.
What's the story with Osiris? This is a guy who got cut up into a bunch of pieces,
yeah.
Like 13 pieces, but they only find 12 of them or something like that?
Yep, 14. They found 13, so you're pretty close on that. by his brother, he killed him and chopped him up in 14 pieces, scattered him throughout the land. His wife, Isis, who was also his sister, they were from West Virginia.
hey, we got stations there.
Just teasing, really. I mean, it makes a funny joke, but, you know, whatever. I'm from Baltimore. Just change it to Baltimore.
All right.
His wife feels compassion on him, so she starts to go around the land to look for these pieces, and she finds 13 of the 14 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And she reassembles them and gives him a proper burial. You see, in antiquity, even in the time of Jesus, and Osiris predates Jesus by hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
That
is the myth of Osiris, is
right.
One of those ancient myths. Okay, gotcha.
Correct. In antiquity, a proper burial was very important, because if you didn't get a proper burial, the belief was that your spirit would wander aimlessly
mm-hmm.
without any rest throughout all eternity. So nobody wanted that. Everybody wanted to have a proper burial. So that's why she went after the pieces. She buried him. There are no accounts of any post-mortem appearances.
Mm-hmm.
In
other words, he doesn't rise from the dead.
No. He becomes a god in the underworld. In essence, he becomes god of the mummies.
Mm-hmm.
As one of my friends said, Osiris coming back to life wasn't a resurrection, it's a zombification.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't even have all of his parts. He's like just walking around in this
right.
Netherworld, which was a very shady, gloomy place.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, there was no resurrection there in any sense.
So would it be safe to say, and we've just covered a couple of them, I don't know how many more there are, but would it be safe to say that these individuals that are candidates for the story of Jesus. That, in other words, the Jesus resurrection story is just kind of a remake of this old thing. It turns out, on closer academic analysis, that in many of the cases, these things that the story of Jesus came from, allegedly, actually happened or were born after the time of Christ, not before the time of Christ, so they can't be the stories from which the Christian account came from.
That, I would agree with that.
That's one group of them. And then the other one are the ones that were actually did predate it, turn out to have almost no, you know, resemblance, hardly, to the details of the life of Jesus himself. It isn't a carbon copy. It's actually very, very different.
Right. Now, that's what the Semitic gods. There are also pagan gods, and these aren't given as much attention to. And I actually think that some of these are better examples than the Semitic gods.
Osiris a Semitic god?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
There are about 25 different cases of the pagan god.
Okay, we only got 3 minutes left, so yep. We have to trim them down here. Give us the best shot.
Basically, a lot of them are just very poor examples. You know, mm-hmm. They just disappear and they're never seen and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are no eyewitnesses, and some of them absolutely have very probable, not just plausible or possible, but probable naturalistic explanations.
Uh-huh.
And of the others, there are just a few finalists that we could look at there and say, well, these could be possibly
contenders, in a sense.
Yeah, like Augustus is one, in which Suetonius in the early 2nd century said that when Augustus died and he was cremated on his funeral pyre, that there was one person in the audience who said that he saw Augustus's spirit ascend through the flames.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one of the, let's say, six finalists we'd be looking at. That's what they kind of
look
like.
Still sounds pretty thin to me.
Yeah, it is. It's very thin.
Well, all of these stories miss another fact, it seems to me, and this is because when I was at Purdue, this issue came up from a couple of different questioners, and they challenged me, or they attempted to do very, very aggressively on this. And my point was just what you said, that a lot of these things postdate the Gospels. The one that predate the Gospels just don't seem to be real contenders because the similarities are so spare. But it strikes me that something else is missed in this discussion, and it's something that we've been talking about the first half of our conversation together, Mike, is that regardless of the similarities, the real case for the resurrection of Jesus Christ has to do with the primary source historical documentation.
Yep, and you can find similarities in a lot of things. Like, for example, in an online article that I have offering a critique of Brian Fleming's film, The God Who Wasn't There, in which he said Jesus never existed, I show that, you know, these parallels are, you can find parallels in just about anything, like, you know, between JFK and Jesus. I mean, yeah. They both started, their names started with the letter J.
Uh-huh.
They both had dads named Joseph.
Right.
And they both, their families both dealt with wine.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, Jesus created wine out of water.
No, that's a good point. Just because there are parallels doesn't mean that one was created out of the other. You always kind of have to look at the, you know, what is the independent evidence for, in this case, the life of Jesus? And as you pointed out in the first part of our discussion, the independent evidence is so strong that regardless of whatever parallels that might seem to exist between prior Messiah myths, this one stands on its own as having independent historical evidence for it. And I'm so glad for the work you're doing, Mike, and I'm glad to have you on board as a friend and a colleague because, you know, when I get, just like we did that first night together, when I get stumped by something, I've got you to turn to. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Mike.
Thanks, Greg. I've always admired you from a distance, so it's been great becoming your friend recently.
Thanks so much. Mike Lacona, author of The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, along with Gary Habermas, also one of the people you'll find in The Case for Real Jesus, the DVD, with the book and the DVD, Case for Christ, and Lee Strobel's work. So, all right, friends, that's it for today. Thank you for joining me this afternoon, and I'll be back with you next week for a 3-hour show. In the meantime, you go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now for Stan to Reason.